Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. And Jared Kushner's messaging habits are now the subject of an investigation by the House Oversight and Reform Committee. The president's son-in-law and top advisor is accused of using the encrypted messaging platform WhatsApp to communicate with foreign leaders. His wife, the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump, is also accused of using a private email account to conduct the White House business. Here's Democratic Congressman Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts. He sits on the committee and spoke with MSNBC.
It's not only the use, which is a real vulnerability to national security, but he's also the things he's doing with that are borderline in terms of legality.
Democrats say Kushner could be violating the Presidential Records Act. Joining me now is Clint Watts, senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He's a former FBI agent and an expert on cybersecurity. Clint, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And let's focus first on Jared Kushner. Top Democrats say he's using an encrypted messaging app to communicate with foreign leaders. Does that concern you?
Yes. The one upside is that WhatsApp is known to be an encrypted app, and it's not uncommon in the region to use that, you know, in the Middle East. But overall, it's just irresponsible because it's going through a system that's not necessarily in the U.S. government's control. How can you do oversight in terms of knowing what communications are there? And at the same time this story was breaking, there's other stories breaking at the New York Times about how private companies are being hired by foreign nations to break into phones, to go into apps, or to hack into people's emails. And I think that really speaks to the dangers of this new world of everyone sort of violating the rules and just using their personal cell phones.
You mentioned that the app is popular in the Middle East. I assume you are referring to some reports that Jared Kushner may have been communicating with the Saudi crown prince. His lawyer has denied that he was speaking with foreign leaders. But Kushner also reportedly took screenshots of his texts and then forwarded them on to his official government account. Is that a security risk?
It is, because, again, this shows the overlap of private and personal email, private and personal communications, very similar to the complaints that were levied against former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in the run-up to 2016 with government business. Imagine you're doing state business for the U.S. government, and your personal accounts are hacked and dumped out there, and it has communications with foreign leaders. Mm. It's just sort of a hypocrisy, double standard that a normal government employee would never be able to do.
Well, many people are making that comparison to Hillary Clinton's private email server. The Trump campaign, of course, as we well know, was happy to use that against her in the 2016 election. Do you see any difference there between these two cases?
No, not at all. I think that was maybe one of the positive outcomes of the email investigation was if you're not following the rules and procedures set forth by the U.S. government, then you're liable to be admonished, you could be fired, or you could even be prosecuted. You know, that was kind of the, if you remember the famous James Comey public statement, you know, it was, we need to get this under control. And you even saw bipartisan support for that on Capitol Hill to a degree after the Clinton email investigation.
I just wonder if there's a distinction to be made between a cell phone and a WhatsApp communication and the fact that Hillary Clinton was using a private server at her home and that there were classified documents on that server.
I don't think there's a distinction. Anybody that's not using official government communications and government standards and procedures in line with policies of those agencies is in the wrong. It doesn't matter whether they have their own server or they're just using commercial applications. All of those things are vulnerable to foreign powers. This is just dangerous. It allows our adversaries to know more about what's going on with our White House officials and State Department officials than it does actually the oversight functions at Capitol Hill and the U.S. intelligence community.
WhatsApp is encrypted, though. Doesn't that make it harder to hack?
It does, but I would remind people that you could go to two different headlines just today in the news. One, that their endpoints, which are cell phones, they're being hacked by these private security companies. On the other side, Facebook is dealing with another scandal, which is the loss of passwords, which were just hung out onto the internet. And WhatsApp is part of the Facebook network of companies and platforms. So anything that's going through a non-U.S. government secure communication channel or official channel can be seen or can be accessed potentially by other people, and the U.S. government may not have oversight of it or be able to defend against it.
Okay, so we have a couple prominent cases that we've been talking about here, but how widespread, from your experience in the FBI, is the use of private email or private encrypted communication within the federal government?
Inside the federal government, I think it's quite low. I think people are oftentimes very worried about it. Mm-hmm. In my time, either working in government, it was strictly forbidden. Now, that tends to change when you go to politicians. I personally experienced different times where they try to do official business on one account, their official business accounts, and then other times they try and skirt by using their own personal communications. And then it comes down to what is official business or what is campaign business. And I think there needs to be one standard across the United States, and I think everyone needs to abide by it.
That's Clint Watts, a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute and a former FBI agent. Clint, thanks for your perspective. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this was the sound heard across New Zealand today.
Allah, wank you, man, Allah, wank you, man.
The Muslim call to prayer as the country marked 1 week since a gunman killed 50 people at two mosques in Christchurch. I spoke earlier with the BBC's Phil Mercer in Christchurch and asked him to describe what happened there today.
Well, this has been quite an extraordinary day of solidarity and remembrance. It started with a Muslim call to prayer that was broadcast on national television and radio. It was followed by a two-minute silence that was observed not just here in Christchurch, but up and down this country of about 4.7 million people. Here in Christchurch, thousands of people attended an open-air service as Friday prayers were held in a park opposite the Al Noor Mosque, where 42 of the 50 victims died a week ago. The Imam Gamal Fuda gave a very powerful sermon saying that when he looked into the eyes of the gunman — the Imam, by the way, survived the attacks — he saw hatred and rage. He said that whilst everyone was heartbroken, they were not broken. He said New Zealand was unbreakable. He also raised the issue of the global scourge of Islamophobia, saying that there was an irrational fear of Islam and the scourge of white-wing nationalism had to be stamped out.
And he thanked the Prime Minister as well in his remarks. She's being praised — this is Jacinda Ardern — being praised worldwide for her leadership during this crisis.
Very compassionate and very decisive. She has said right from the word go that she would pursue gun controls after the atrocity perpetrated here last Friday. She's been to Christchurch three times in the past week, offering solace and leadership. 24 hours ago, she said that the types of weapons used in the attacks here would be banned. That includes all military-style semi-automatic firearms and assault rifles. That new law could be in place by the 11th of April. Gun owners who have to hand in their weapons will be compensated. Those who resist could be prosecuted. And the Police Association, which is essentially the trade union for police officers in New Zealand, says there's a need, too, for a nationwide register of all guns and their owners. And I think many New Zealanders are just happy that the Prime Minister has shown such decisive leadership at this time of great national tragedy.
Phil, those of us who lived through 9/11 in the United States know that everything changed after that event. Does it feel in New Zealand that the country has changed permanently because of what happened last week?
Well, up until quite recently, many New Zealanders would have considered their small country perched at the bottom of the world to be far away from the world's trouble spots, insulated from all the extremist violence that people here have seen and heard about for so many years. I get the sense that the terrible events here of a week ago will have changed all of that. New Zealand's reputation as a place of safety has come to an end. I think there is a grim realization here that New Zealand is quite clearly not immune to these sorts of things. And perhaps it's the terrible experience of some of the victims of these shootings. A father and son who were buried earlier this week, they were refugees from Syria. They only arrived in New Zealand last year seeking a place of safety, and now they lie in a grave alongside so many other victims. And I think that is just an illustration as to how New Zealand has changed. It is no longer seen as the safe, insulated country that it once was. But of course, the challenge for New Zealand now is to heal and try to recover some of that reputation, and perhaps the new gun laws and certainly the acts of solidarity we've seen today could go some way to restore New Zealand's reputation as a place where people want to come and live very safe and peaceful lives.
That is the BBC's Phil Mercer speaking with us from Christchurch, New Zealand, a week after the mosque attacks. Phil, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Some Virginia college students are participating in a political research project inspired by one of the most racially charged controversies of the year. The story starts in February, when Virginia Governor Ralph Northam and Attorney General Mark Herring admitted to appearing in blackface in the 1980s. A group of activists wondered if other politicians might have similar uncovered stories in their past. So the activists enlisted Richmond-area students from historically black colleges to search through the politicians' yearbooks. Megan Pauley of member station WCVE reports.
I met up with four Virginia State political science students in their campus library between classes. A few weeks ago, their professor, Dr. Wes Bellamy, sent out a group text message asking if they'd be interested in a special research fellowship.
All we seen was research, paid, college student, money, knowledge. Yes. Yeah.
That's 19-year-old sophomore Janice Jefferson. She and her classmates will look into yearbooks from a variety of local universities to see what they can find out about politicians who went to school in Virginia. Jefferson isn't new to politics. She grew up going to school board meetings with her mother in her hometown of Manassas Park, Virginia. But she's excited to hone her research skills.
Just going beyond the surface, going beyond Google, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, using databases and scholarly articles and stuff instead of just, you know, Wikipedia.
Chelsea Higgs Wise, a local activist, came up with the idea for the fellowship. She's a member of the Richmond Metro Area Young Democrats and volunteered to campaign for Virginia Governor Ralph Northam in 2017.
I started noticing throughout the campaign that he was not very comfortable talking about African Americans or people of color.
That bothered her, and she feels like now's the time to hold Northam and other politicians accountable. She wondered what would their yearbooks have to say about them, and she thought, who better to look than students from historically black universities?
This is about providing resources to students of color to learn different skills of research and archiving, as well as to pay them for having to live through and survive the type of images that they're going to be seeing. That's traumatizing to see that.
Another important part of the fellowship, Wise says, will be about helping students decompress and discuss the images they're seeing and the history from painful racist chapters of Richmond's past. Wise works with a nonprofit that leads these kinds of discussions called Initiatives of Change. A number of area universities have also signed on to help. Irina Rogova is an archivist with the University of Richmond. She'll teach students research tips, things like how to tag topics so they're searchable.
How I explain it to students sometimes, I'm like, it's like a hashtag. You want to collect things.
She's already doing that now with the college's Race and Racism Project, which helps catalyze conversations about the school's history.
There were definitely instances of the raising of the Confederate flag. There was something called the Old South Ball that would be put on and the men would come in Confederate uniforms. We have the Confederate spider mascot as well.
Students realize they may not like what they find out. 17-year-old freshman Michaela Walker interned this year with Virginia Senator Jeremy McPike. She said she's hesitant to dig into his yearbook.
I don't know about that. I like my job, so I don't know about that.
The students at Virginia State will work with another group of students from Virginia Union University, another local historically black school. After they wrap up their work over the summer, they'll share it with local high school students and local reporters. For NPR News, I'm Megan Pauley in Richmond.
Okay, now let's go on a mushroom quest. You might remember Robin's recent conversation with mushroom guru Paul Stamets, who says they can treat tuberculosis and cancer. There's also some evidence that mushrooms can help reduce the risk of mild cognitive impairment. But first, you got to eat them. That's why our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, is here. Kathy, welcome.
Hi there.
Hey, so there are all sorts of mushrooms in the store these days, and if you ask me, some of them are pretty intimidating to look at. So can you just run through the basics here and catch us up to speed?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about mushrooms is that they're not only good for you, but boy, do they taste good. They're meaty. They're earthy. They're really great for vegetarians because of that meatiness. And yet, it runs the gamut from very delicate spring mushrooms to some of the later mushrooms in the fall. Tastes like eating the forest in the best way.
Are there seasons for mushrooms?
Very much so. So this time of year in certain parts of the country, people are out looking for morels, a prize spring mushroom. They have a kind of smoky flavor that people love to saute. Also in the spring, in certain parts of the country, you can find porcini. They are very intense with a rich, meaty flavor, used a lot in Italian food with pasta and risotto. If you see these fresh, grab them.
Okay, you've got my appetite going. So let's eat some of these dishes, starting with, this looks like a mushroom scramble.
It is indeed. We thought we'd start simple, and I feel like this is like a Dr. Seuss poem. It could be a 3, 4, 5, or 6 mushroom scramble. In this one, we used portobellos, white mushrooms, also called button mushrooms, shiitake, another prized Asian variety, golden oyster, and oyster mushrooms. And they're simply sliced and sauteed with spring chives and some scallions. And then you whisk eggs with more chives and scallions, fold them into these sautéed mushrooms, and then add a dollop of sour cream at the end. This is the recipe for all the people that say, wow, that sounds really good, but I have like 5 minutes. It's a 10-minute recipe that is just packed with flavor. What do you think?
It's absolutely delicious. And I make a lot of scrambled eggs at home, but I never add mushrooms because they scare me a little bit.
What is it that scares you? Tell me your problems.
Well, I don't know exactly how to cook them. So if I made them in scrambled eggs, is that different than, say, for example, if I were to roast them?
So there are many different ways to cook mushrooms. Sauteing them is perhaps the simplest. What you want to do is just cut a tiny bit of the end off. You can eat all the stems. You want to slice it with the stems, no waste, because some of these mushrooms get to be pretty pricey. But let's segue into the idea of roasting a mushroom. When you saute it, it hits hot heat in a skillet, preferably with some olive oil, maybe some butter. It gets golden brown. But when you roast them, what happens is something different. I feel like roasting it in a high temperature oven brings out the earthy and all the nuance of mushrooms. So the next dish is simply a variety of mushrooms roasted at high temperature, 425, for about 20 minutes with garlic and shallots and olive oil.
Again, this one is delicious, and I'm noticing a little difference in the consistency. It's almost a little more al dente.
Exactly. The roasting brings out different textures and different flavors. You can throw some parsley on that. You could also throw a little heavy cream in the end if you wanted something richer and serve it on grilled toast. You could throw it on pasta or risotto. This is also a recipe where you cut some mushrooms, you toss them with some garlic and shallots and olive oil, and you throw them in the oven and walk away.
Love it.
Super simple.
All right, dish number 3. I've got some asparagus and some mushrooms. It looks like a little salad.
It is a salad, and we are getting into that time of year where asparagus are coming out in the market. And again, a variety of mushrooms, shiitake, oyster, cremini, and I toss them with Asian flavors, sesame oil, rice wine vinegar, a little soy sauce, some fresh ginger and scallions, and if you like, a little fish sauce. And then in a separate skillet, I roast the asparagus. The mushrooms get very juicy with the sesame oil and rice wine vinegar. You take it out, you put the warm asparagus on a plate, you top them with the mushrooms and all those juices from the bottom of the pan, and you have a very sophisticated roast mushroom and asparagus salad.
That asparagus makes it taste so fresh, and that gets us to the health benefits of this food, mushrooms. Are they as good as people say they are?
They are considered a superfood. They're loaded with antioxidants. They have the nutritional benefits of vegetables, but they also have those commonly found in meat, grains, and beans. The other really great thing about them is that 3 ounces of most mushrooms runs you about 20 calories.
Wow.
No fat. So this is a win-win kind of food. Huge flavor, huge nutritional benefits, super low in calorie. How often do we get to say that?
Do you use dried mushrooms if you can't find what you're looking for in the store?
I do all the time because particularly with some of these more exotic varieties or the seasonal ones like morels and porcini, if you find them dried, you can keep them for a year or more. And what's beautiful about these mushrooms is that you soak them in almost boiling water. They come back to life and then you drain them. But the key also is that liquid that you soak the mushroom in becomes an instant mushroom broth. And it is fabulous to use in soups and stews and in risotto or any type of pasta dish. So if you do buy dried mushrooms, don't throw out the water.
All right. Good advice. Kathy, I know a lot of people have this hobby. They go hunting for their own mushrooms. I just wondered if you're ever tempted to do that up in the forests of Maine to find some of these goodies.
Years ago, I went with a professional forager and had one of the great days of my life collecting all these wild mushrooms, but it terrifies me.
Yeah.
And one needs to do it with an absolute expert, and even that is often not that safe. I would not advise people just going into the woods and looking at something going, oh, that looks edible, because often the most beautiful mushrooms are the most poisonous. There are mycology societies across the U.S. where you can go out on hikes and learn about mushrooms. But boy, I say use enormous caution.
Kathy, thank you so much. These dishes were delicious, and we're going to post all of them at hereandnow.org.
Thank you.
And while you're there, Kathy Gunst has got a lot more advice on mushrooms, like how should you wash them before you eat them.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped as much as 400 points this morning as fears of a global economic slowdown are growing. This following the Federal Reserve's plan not to raise interest rates this year, as well as fears about Brexit and a slump in German manufacturing. One bright spot, U.S. home sales jumped to their highest level in 11 months. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with Brexit. EU leaders have given British Prime Minister Theresa May 2 more weeks to work out a Brexit deal. If she can't get Parliament to support her Brexit plan next week, then Britain has until April 12th to come up with another plan or leave the EU without a deal. If her plan is approved next week, then Britain has until May 22nd. To leave the EU. What are the global economic concerns at this point with all of what's going on with Brexit?
You know, Jeremy, I think if you count up all the ifs in the statement you just made, it shows there's almost this paralysis in certain sectors of the European economy because of Brexit. You mentioned that slump in German manufacturing. The firm that put out that survey, IHS Market, their head economist basically said Brexit and to some degree the U.S.-China trade war are causing so much uncertainty that that's a big reason why that German manufacturing is slipping. And it makes sense if you think, you know, if you're trying to plan your orders for goods 6 months or a year out and you have no idea what the tariff situation will be with Britain, it makes it very difficult for companies to do long-term planning. So we are already seeing sort of this effect of the uncertainty surrounding Brexit in the economic data. I think in the worst case scenario, if Britain is to leave with no deal, that uncertainty is going to linger on for some time longer, and just a general concern about chaos and people not knowing what to do, how to plan in that scenario.
Okay, so let's talk about the little glimmer of hope here in the news today. The U.S. new housing numbers, home sales way up in February, but we're also hearing about a slowdown in housing. What do you make of it?
Well, you're right. The existing home sales numbers that came out today showed a very strong increase, 12% in February. That rate of change is the most since the end of 2015. And it really shows how sensitive the housing market is to interest rates, which have come down significantly. And it's a very important part of the economy. I mean, anyone who's ever bought a home realizes when you buy a home, you often have to buy new appliances and you hire someone to fix up part of the house, and you might buy new furniture. So it has a very big ripple effect whenever someone buys or sells a home. So it's good to see those numbers come back like that.
At the same time, it seems like the big concern, and maybe what's driving the markets most, is not about Brexit or German manufacturing or mortgages. It's just the general sense that maybe we're due for a slowdown.
Yeah, and one of the things investors on Wall Street have really fixated on, it's kind of obscure, but the yield curve. And today, the rate on three-month treasuries rose above the yield on 10-year treasuries. You know, it kind of sounds like that old Onion story, the red line rose above the blue line.
Right.
But this is actually considered a fairly accurate warning sign of a recession, not necessarily tomorrow, but, you know, within a year or two when interest rates behave that way. So
it's been a good predictor in the past.
Yes,
and we're going to have to leave it right there. Mike Regan, thank you. A federal judge has delayed the hearing for actress Lori Loughlin and her husband until next month in that college admissions bribery case. They'll appear April 3rd on charges that they paid $500,000 in bribes to get their daughters into the University of Southern California. The scandal, uncovered by federal authorities, involves dozens of people and has put a new focus on fairness in the college application process. We're going to look now at the history of college admissions with historians Brian Ballow and Ed Ayers, co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And first of all, were you surprised that there are people right now in 2019 willing to break the law just to get their kids into college?
Well, me personally, I was about as surprised as they were in Casablanca to discovering that there was gambling there. Shocked, simply shocked. And the reason I say that is, at least as an historian, rich people have gotten their kids into college for, well, pretty much the history of colleges. That is the baseline, Jeremy.
Well, take us back then to the beginning. Who were these schools originally built for, the early days of higher education in America?
And higher education begins very early in American history, 17th century at Harvard, and then lots of other schools all around. And they were basically created to create a learned clergy at first, but that rapidly expands into a learned legal profession and the other professions. And the trick was that you had to know Latin and Greek, and often Hebrew, to go to them, which gives you some idea of who they're made for. Mm. That was pretty much the story in the 17th and 18th centuries, and a lot of the 19th century, until we create land-grant colleges. 1862, the great vision of colleges for rural people, that every state would be given land on which they could build a university.
And that really distinguished us, didn't it, Ed?
Oh, it
did.
That
was just different about America.
Well, you know, it's a great advantage of the federal system that everybody gets something. But here, you know, this is where all the techs and the states.
A lot of the state schools now are land-grant universities still.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, all the big universities that you think of, University of Michigan State, all those places, are land-grants. And so that changed everything. And it was meant to change everything. It was meant to say that college is for everyone, and not just people who speak ancient languages, but for people who want to be excellent farmers. And they were famously inexpensive. relatively easy to get into, including for women. In fact, this is one of the great democratic innovations in all of American history.
And of course, there were a lot of historically black colleges that opened up at that time too, right?
Yeah, those were created in the wake of emancipation all across the South. And so you'd have people who had been born into slavery who were then going to college. It's a wonderful innovation as well. We mm-hmm. think about Booker T. Washington. It opens the doors for all these people. So you have these parallel tracks toward democracy, and you're also having colleges for women being created at this time as well. So in the late 19th century, early 20th century, it looks as if college is going to be really something everybody can benefit from.
That's absolutely right, but everyone was really not all that many people.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? I mean, a lot of people just didn't see the reason to go to college, and one of the limiting factors that we usually don't think about, Jeremy, is before you go to college, you needed to go to high school.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And most Americans didn't really start getting high school degrees until around the time of World War II. So there just wasn't that large a pool of people who would even think about going to college, in spite of this opening for African Americans and for women.
So when did colleges start to be seen as prestigious places that you would strive to get into for a successful life later on?
Well, that's been the case all along, right? What's new is not the exclusion, but rather the great opening. And that happens with World War II and the GI Bill. I mean, this is really what opened the door for a lot of lower-class white men who would not have been able to have gone to college before, but suddenly Uncle Sam is footing the bill, and it makes sense for them to go to college.
Yeah, and it caused all kinds of disruptions. Colleges weren't used to seeing this kind of college student. It really was very universalistic within the realm of white men. And I think we both want to emphasize white men because even though African Americans served in the military and were veterans, they didn't have those high school degrees. They couldn't take advantage of this incredible benefit that the federal government was offering. And women did a lot to help the war, but not many of them qualified for veterans benefits.
And then picking up on that, the huge demographic surge of the baby boom generation, you'd see college attendance rates reaching all-time highs in, I think, 1970, 71. But as you asked, Jeremy, how did it become exclusive at the same time? And ironically, these two things are not unrelated. When it becomes common for people to get a college degree, getting a really extra special college degree
right. mm-hmm.
becomes even more important as a way of differentiating yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe an Ivy League education. And
that
brings me to my next question.
That's one vision of special sauce.
Right.
Absolutely.
Well, and so do these elite schools like Stanford and Yale and Harvard deserve their prestigious reputations?
I think they do. If you measure them in terms of, you know, the income that you're going to make if you've gone to a place like this, people who go there make more money. But I don't think that's a great way to measure the word you use, Jeremy, which is prestige. Even if you're a lowly history professor, you're not going to make nearly as much as the petroleum engineer who went to Oklahoma State. But if you're a history professor who went to Harvard, well, then that just conveys a kind of specialness that is out there in society. I'm not in any way saying it's deserved, but I think it's a real factor.
And it's also a real factor in terms of life partners and business partners and, you know.
Your network, basically.
Your network. I mean, it matters enormously. And, of course, then you have networks within networks. So it's not enough to go to an Ivy League school. You have to be in the right dining club or.
Right. It's network, not net worth. But the two are very much related.
Now, we hear a lot about how colleges today covet diversity, including the most elite ones. Do you think that that is true? Is that an illusion? What do you think?
No, I mean, we are admitting the most diverse classes ethnically and in terms of gender in American history.
And in terms of country of origin.
Well, that's right, too. We're the great magnet for international students. And here's the thing is that these colleges and universities are spending enormous amounts of money, mainly by redistributing the money of rich people who are paying full freight. A large part of the tuition of people who are paying $50,000 or $60,000 a year is plowed back into financial aid for others. And so people have recognized that you're not going to be a prestigious university if you don't look like America. You know, if you're talking about building these networks, you need to capture as much of the talent in the country as possible. And people are finally beginning to realize that talent comes in all shapes and colors.
So from a historical perspective, what should we make of this current scandal of parents bribing, paying off people to get their kids into college?
Well, from any perspective, it's reprehensible. I mean, let's just say that flat out. But I do think, Jeremy, that we pile so many expectations on universities, on education in general. We expect them to solve gigantic social problems that really are well beyond the pale in terms of what they can do to educate. And I think that we do that because there's something that is not on the table through much of American history, and that's the R word, which is redistribution. And so because we're not willing explicitly to do things that would redistribute income, wealth, and early opportunity, like where people live, where they go to school early on, we say, it's okay. This is all going to get solved by a better education system.
You know, I think one of the expectations that people pile on college universities is that it will somehow be a meritocracy. And in my best days, I believe it's as close to a meritocracy as we're going to get. But it also has a kind of a money laundering effect. What it means is that it doesn't really matter how you got there, including maybe buying your way in, but then you are seen as merited once you've graduated. So at the same time it creates prestige, it makes the prestige seem earned rather than purchased. And I think that's why this remarkable degree of outrage has met this relatively few number of people who are doing this, because it seems a violation of sort of the secular gospel of this country, which is that people deserve what they get.
They are the co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory and historians Brian Ballow and Ed Ayers. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Much of the Midwest is trying to recover from this week's devastating floods, and a new warning from government scientists says the danger is only getting worse. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said yesterday that up to 13 million people around the country could be exposed to major flooding this spring, and that nearly two-thirds of the lower 48 states are at a higher risk of getting swamped by rain and snowmelt. In Fargo, North Dakota, the mayor has declared an emergency. He's calling on volunteers to fill 1 million sandbags in the next few days to protect the city from the swollen Red River. Mayor Tim Mahoney joins us now. Mayor, welcome. How are you?
Well, getting ready. A little nervous about what's headed towards our way.
Yeah.
We're having beautiful weather, so we're starting to get a melt here.
Beautiful weather now, but that snow is melting, and that's what the threat is. To reach that goal of 1 million sandbags, it sounds like you have to fill about 100,000 sandbags a day. How are you going to do that?
Well, in our previous flood fights, we've kind of learned how to do this, so we call a machine called a spider. So what a spider does is it has 8 legs that come down off the spider that give sand, and you grab them and put a sand bag underneath them, fill it with sand, tie it off, and put it on the pallets. So if you have about 100 people that want to work someday, they could handle a spider. So we run 2 spiders. It takes 200 people. And one wonderful exercise of making sandbags.
Mm. Where are those people coming from?
They usually come from all over the community. Part of what happens is middle schoolers just love to do sandbags, and so do high school kids. So sometimes we reach from them. And then the other people are the businesses in town. Your banks and your different people will help us out in this regard.
Okay, and so once you have 1 million sandbags ready to go, where are you putting them along the banks of the river?
Well, in 2009, when we had a flood event that was smaller than this predicted one, we needed 6.5 million bags. So we call 1 million bags a lot easier to do. But now what we'd have to do is we've done a lot of dikes and we've done a lot of walls, so we have some neighborhoods that just would need some sandbags in the back for as a primary defense. and that grouping is now a smaller number than we've ever had. That's where we'd put it in neighborhoods and houses, and behind those houses, that's where we'd put the sandbags.
Now, we remember that flood along the Red River in 2009. I'm sure you remember it far better than we do. Are you saying that there's a chance that this year could be just as bad or worse than 2009?
So the flood record we have is 40.84 inches was our flood record in 2009, and that was a 5% possibility. The 5% possibility right now that the Weather Service is putting out is at a 42-foot level. So, yeah, we're quite nervous about this one, because if it gets to the worst event, if we have a rain event in April, that could push it to a higher level. So that's what we're dealing with right now.
What has the city done since 2009 to prepare for another big one?
We've done about $438 million worth of work throughout the city, and we've bought out homes that were along the river, torn them down, and put up clay dikes in those situations. In areas that are closer to the city or closer to homes, we've also put in concrete dikes that have gone up at 44 feet. So we have a lot more protection than we had at the time of 2009, and our need for diking and sandbags in 2009 was 52 miles. We now have that down to 20 miles that we will have to do some type of work to protect the city.
So at what point this year are you prepared to tell people they have to leave their homes?
One of the things you'll find about Fargo is evacuation is not an option. So we will always work as vigorous as we can to win a flood fight. I anticipate that option would be out, just because here's the issue you have with that. The best people to watch the dikes or the walls are the people that live in those houses. So what we always do in that consideration is we want people in the community to help us fight the flood. 2009, we had 100,000 volunteers, but our key volunteers were along the dikes. And oftentimes, those are homeowners. So they would patrol the dikes every hour, and it's something that it's a little more personal when you're worried about your home.
Yeah.
So we find that it'd be very hard for us to ever consider evacuation.
So how are you feeling? I mean, I'm sure you're watching what's happening across the Midwest. You know that you could be next. That's got to be very unsettling.
Yeah, Nebraska's footage is horrible, and what happened in that community, you're just very concerned about if we get a freak weather system that drops a lot of water on us, that could really make this flood fight much different. So we're going to be prepared for whatever comes at us, but we have to hope for a slow melt. So that's right now mild anxiety as I get closer to determinative flow, then I'll tell you where I'll be at.
All right. Well, we'll be hoping along with you. That's Mayor Tim Mahoney, mayor of Fargo, North Dakota, calling for 1 million sandbags to be filled as the Red River threatens to flood the city. Mayor, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And later this afternoon, on All Things Considered, we'll have the latest on the rescue and recovery effort underway in Mozambique and neighboring African countries following that devastating cyclone that hit land last week. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.